Random House Audio presents The Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood. Read for you by Bernadette Dunn, Katie McNichol, and Mark Bramhall.
The Garden. Who is it tends the garden, oh so green? 'Twas once the finest garden that ever has been seen. And in it God's dear creatures did swim and fly and play. But then came greedy spoilers and killed them all away. And all the trees that flourished and gave us wholesome fruit by waves of sand are buried, both leaf and branch and root. And all the shining water is turned to slime and mire, and all the feathered birds so bright have ceased their joyful choir. O garden, O my garden, I'll mourn forevermore until the gardeners arise and you to life restore. From the God's Gardener's Oral Hymn Book.
Chapter 1. Toby. Year 25. The Year of the Flood. In the early morning, Toby climbs up to the rooftop to watch the sunrise. She uses a mop handle for balance. The elevator stopped working some time ago, and the back stairs are slick with damp, so if she slips and topples, there won't be anyone there to pick her up. As the first heat hits, mist rises from among the swath of trees between her and the derelict city. The air smells faintly of burning, a smell of caramel and tar and rancid barbecues, and the ashy but greasy smell of a garbage dump fire after it's been raining. The abandoned towers in the distance are like the coral of an ancient reef, bleached and colorless, devoid of life. There still is life, however. Birds chirp. Sparrows, they must be. Their small voices are clear and sharp. Nails on glass. There's no longer any sound of traffic to drown them out. Do they notice that quietness, the absence of motors? If so, are they happier? Toby has no idea. Unlike some of the other gardeners, the more wild-eyed or possibly overdosed ones, she has never been under the illusion that she can converse with birds. The sun brightens in the east, reddening the blue-gray haze that marks the distant ocean. The vultures roosting on hydropoles fan out their wings to dry them, opening themselves like black umbrellas. One and then another lifts off on the thermals and spirals upwards. If they plummet suddenly, it means they've spotted carrion. Vultures are our friends, the gardeners used to teach. They purify the earth. They are God's necessary dark angels of bodily dissolution. Imagine how terrible it would be if there were no death. Do I still believe this? Toby wonders. Everything is different up close. The rooftop has some planters, their ornamentals running wild. It has a few fake wood benches. It used to have a sun canopy for cocktail hour, but that's been blown away. Toby sits on one of the benches to survey the grounds. She lifts her binoculars, scanning from left to right. The driveway, with its lumerose borders, untidy now as frayed hairbrushes, their purple glow fading in the strengthening light. The western entrance done in pink adobe-style solar skin. The snarl of tangled cars outside the gate. The flower beds choked with south thistle and burdock, enormous aqua kudzu moths fluttering above them. The fountains, their scallop-shell basins filled with stagnant rainwater. The parking lot, with a pink golf cart and two pink Anuyu spa minivans, each with its winking eye logo. There's a fourth minivan, farther along the drive, crashed into a tree. There used to be an arm hanging out of the window, but it's gone now. The wide lawns have grown up, tall weeds. There are low, irregular mounds beneath the milkweed and fleabane and sorrel, with here and there, A swatch of fabric. A glint of bone. That's where the people fell. The ones who'd been running or staggering across the lawn. Toby had watched from the roof, crouched behind one of the planters, but she hadn't watched for long. Some of those people had called for help, as if they'd known she was there. But how could she have helped? The swimming pool has a mottled blanket of algae. Already there are frogs. The herons and the egrets and the peagrets hunt them at the shallow end. For a while, Toby tried to scoop out the small animals that had blundered in and drowned. The luminous green rabbits, the rats, the rackunks with their striped tails and raccoon bandit masks. But now, she leaves them alone. Maybe they'll generate fish somehow, when the pool is more like a swamp. Is she thinking of eating these theoretical future fish? Surely not. Surely not yet. She turns to the dark and circling wall of trees and vines and fronds and shrubby undergrowth, probing it with her binoculars. It's from there that any danger might come. But what kind of danger? She can't imagine. In the night, there are the usual noises. The faraway barking of dogs, the tittering of mice, the waterpipe notes of the crickets, the occasional grump of a frog. The blood rushing in her ears. Katoosh, katoosh, katoosh. A heavy broom sweeping dry leaves. Go to sleep, she says out loud. But she never sleeps well, not since she's been alone in this building. Sometimes she hears voices, human voices, calling to her in pain. Or the voices of women, the women who used to work here, the anxious women who used to come for rest and rejuvenation, splashing in the pool, strolling on the lawns. All the pink voices, soothed and soothing. Or the voices of the gardeners, murmuring or singing, or the children laughing together up on the Edencliffe garden. Adam One and Nuala and Bert. Old Pilar, surrounded by her bees. And Zeb. If any one of them is still alive, it must be Zeb. Any day now he'll come walking along the roadway or appear from among the trees. But he must be dead by now. It's better to think so, not to waste hope. There must be someone else left, though. She can't be the only one on the planet. There must be others. But friends or foes? If she sees one, how to tell? She's prepared. The doors are locked, the windows barred. But even such barriers are no guarantee. Every hollow space invites invasion. Even when she sleeps, she's listening, as animals do, for a break in the pattern, for an unknown sound, for a silence opening like a crack in rock. When the small creatures hush their singing, said Adam One, it's because they're afraid. You must listen for the sound of their fear.
Chapter 2. Wren. Year 25. The Year of the Flood. Beware of words. Be careful what you write. Leave no trails. This is what the gardeners taught us when I was a child among them. They told us to depend on memory, because nothing written down could be relied on. The spirit travels from mouth to mouth, not from thing to thing. Books could be burnt, paper crumble away, computers could be destroyed. Only the spirit lives forever, and the spirit isn't a thing. As for writing, it was dangerous, said the Adams and the Eves, because your enemies could trace you through it and hunt you down and use your words to condemn you. But now that the waterless flood has swept over us, any writing I might do is safe enough, because those who would have used it against me are most likely dead. So I can write down anything I want. What I write is my name, Wren, with an eyebrow pencil on the wall beside the mirror. I've written it a lot of times. Wren, 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 like a song. You can forget who you are if you're alone too much. Amanda told me that. I can't see out the window. It's glass brick. I can't get out the door. It's locked on the outside. I still have air, though, and water, as long as the solar doesn't quit. I still have food. I'm lucky. I'm really very lucky. Count your luck, Amanda used to say. So I do. First, I was lucky to be working here at Scales when the flood hit. Second, it was even luckier that I was shut up this way in the sticky zone because it kept me safe. I got a rip in my biofilm body glove. A client got carried away and bit me right through the green sequins, and I was waiting for my test results. It wasn't a wet rip with secretions and membranes involved. It was a dry rip near the elbow, so I wasn't that worried. Still, they checked everything here at Scales. They had a reputation to keep up. We were known as the cleanest dirty girls in town. Scales and Tails took care of you. They really did. If you were talent, that is. Good food, a doctor if you needed one, and the tips were great because the men from the top corps came here. It was well run, though it was in a seedy area. All the clubs were. That was a matter of image, Mortis would say. Seedy was good for business, because unless there's an edge, something lurid or tawdry, a whiff of sleaze, what separated our brand from the run-of-the-mill product the guy could get at home with the face cream and the white cotton panties? Mortis believed in plain speaking. He'd been in the business ever since he was a kid, and when they outlawed the pimps and the street trade, for public health and the safety of women, they said, and rolled everything into SexMart under Corpsey Corp's control, Mortis made the jump because of his experience. It's who you know, he used to say, and what you know about them. Then he'd grin and pat you on the bum. Just a friendly pat, though. He never took freebies from us. He had ethics. He was a wiry guy with a shaved head and black, shiny, alert eyes like the heads of ants, and he was easy as long as everything was cool. But he'd stand up for us if the clients got violent. Nobody hurts my best girls, he'd say. It was a point of honor with him. Also, he didn't like waste. We were a valuable asset, he'd say, the cream of the crop. After the SexMart roll-in, anyone left outside the system was not only illegal, but pathetic. A few wrecked, diseased old women wandering the alleyways, practically begging. No man with even a fraction of his brain left would go anywhere near them. Hazardous waste, we Scales girls used to call them. We shouldn't have been so scornful. We should have had compassion. But compassion takes work, and we were young. That night, when the waterless flood began, I was waiting for my test results. They kept you locked in the sticky zone for weeks in case you had something contagious. The food came in through the safety-sealed hatchway, plus there was the mini-fridge with snacks, and the water was filtered, coming in and out both. You had everything you needed, but it got boring in there. You could exercise on the machines, and I did a lot of that, because a trapeze dancer needs to keep in practice. You could watch TV or old movies, play your music, talk on the phone, or you could visit the other rooms in Scales on the intercom video screens. Sometimes when we were doing plank work, we'd wink at the cameras in mid-moan for the benefit of whoever was stuck in the sticky zone. We knew where the cameras were hidden, in the snake skin or feather work on the ceilings. It was one big family at Scales, so even when you were in the sticky zone, Mortis liked you to pretend you were still participating. Mortis made me feel so secure. I knew if I was in big trouble, I could go to him. There were only a few people in my life like that. Amanda most of the time. Zeb, sometimes. And Toby. You wouldn't think it would be Toby. She was so tough and hard. But if you're drowning, a soft, squashy thing is no good to hold on to. You need something more solid.
Creation Day. Year 5. Of the creation and of the naming of the animals. Spoken by Adam 1.
Dear friends, dear fellow creatures, dear fellow mammals, on Creation Day 5 years ago, this Eden Cliff rooftop garden of ours was a sizzling wasteland, hemmed in by festering city slums and dens of wickedness. But now, it has blossomed as the rose. By covering such barren rooftops with greenery, we are doing our small part in the redemption of God's creation from the decay and sterility that lies all around us, and feeding ourselves with unpolluted food into the bargain. Some would term our efforts futile, but if all were to follow our example, what a change would be wrought on our beloved planet. Much hard work still lies before us, but fear not, my friends, for we shall move forward undaunted. I'm glad we have all remembered our sun hats. Now, let us turn our minds to our annual Creation Day devotion. The human words of God speak of the creation in terms that could be understood by the men of old. There is no talk of galaxies or genes, for such terms would have confused them greatly. But must we therefore take as scientific fact the story that the world was created in 6 days, thus making a nonsense of observable data? God cannot be held to the narrowness of literal and materialistic interpretations, nor measured by human measurements, for his days are eons, and 1,000 ages of our time are like an evening to him. Unlike some other religions, we have never felt it served a higher purpose to lie to children about geology. Remember the first sentences of those human words of God: "The earth is without form and void," and then God speaks light into being. This is the moment that science terms the Big Bang, as if it were a sex orgy. Yet both accounts concur in their essence: darkness, then in an instant, light. But surely the creation is ongoing, for are not new stars being formed at every moment? God's days are not consecutive, my friends. They run concurrently, the first with the third, the fourth with the sixth. As we are told, "Thou sendest forth thy spirit, they are created, and thou renewest the face of the earth." We are told that on the fifth day of God's creating activities, the waters brought forth creatures, and on the sixth day the dry land was populated with animals and with plants and trees, and all were blessed and told to multiply. And finally Adam, that is to say mankind, was created. According to science, this is the same order in which the species did in fact appear on the planet, man last of all, or more or less the same order, or close enough. What happens next? God brings the animals before man to see what he would call them. But why didn't God already know what names Adam would choose? The answer can only be that God has given Adam free will, and therefore Adam may do things that God himself cannot anticipate in advance. Think of that the next time you are tempted by meat-eating or material wealth. Even God may not always know what you are going to do next. God must have caused the animals to assemble by speaking to them directly. But what language did he use? It was not Hebrew, my friends. It was not Latin or Greek or English or French or Spanish or Arabic or Chinese. No, he called the animals in their own languages. To the reindeer, he spoke reindeer. To the spider, spider. To the elephant, he spoke elephant. To the flea, he spoke flea. To the centipede, he spoke centipede. And to the ant, ant. So must it have been. And for Adam himself, the names of the animals were the first words he spoke, the first moment of human language. In this cosmic instant, Adam claims his human soul. To name is, we hope, to greet, to draw another towards oneself. Let us imagine Adam calling out the names of the animals in fondness and joy, as if to say, "There you are, my dearest. Welcome." Adam's first act toward the animals was thus one of loving kindness and kinship, for man in his unfallen state was not yet a carnivore. The animals knew this and did not run away. So it must have been on that unrepeatable day, a peaceful gathering at which every living entity on the earth was embraced by man. How much have we lost, dear fellow mammals and fellow mortals? How much have we willfully destroyed? How much do we need to restore within ourselves? The time of the naming is not over, my friends. In his sight, we may still be living in the sixth day. As your meditation, imagine yourself rocked in that sheltering moment. Stretch out your hand towards those gentle eyes that regard you with such trust, a trust that has not yet been violated by bloodshed and gluttony and pride and disdain. Say their names. Let us sing. When Adam First.
Now when Adam first had breath of life, all in that golden place, he dwelt in peace with bird and beast. God face to face. Man's spirit first went forth in speech to name each creature dear. And God called to all in fellowship where they came without a fear. Here they romped and played, they sang and flew. Each motion was a praise for God's great creativity. Those early days, how shrunk, how dwindled in our time, creation's mighty seed. For man has broke the fellowship with the murder, lust, and
Chapter 3. Toby, Podocarp Day. Year 25. It's daybreak. The break of day. Toby turns this word over. Break. Broke. Broken. What breaks in daybreak? Is it the night? Is it the sun, cracked in two by the horizon like an egg, spilling out light? She lifts her binoculars. The trees look as innocent as ever, yet she has the feeling that someone's watching her, as if even the most inert stone or stump can sense her and doesn't wish her well. Isolation produces such effects. She'd trained for them during the God's gardener's vigils and retreats. The floating orange triangle, the talking crickets, the writhing columns of vegetation, the eyes in the leaves. Still, how to distinguish between such illusions and the real thing? The sun's fully up now, smaller, hotter. Toby makes her way down from the rooftop, covers herself in her pink top to toe, sprays with Super D for the bugs, and adjusts her broad pink sun hat. Then she unlocks the front door and goes out to tend the garden. This is where they used to grow the ladies' organic salads for the spa cafe. their garnishes, their exotic spliced vegetables, their herbal teas. There's overhead netting to thwart the birds, and a chain-link fence because of the green rabbits and the bob kittens and the raccoons that might wander in from the park. These weren't numerous before the flood, but it's astonishing how quickly they've been multiplying. She's counting on this garden. Her supplies in the storeroom are getting low. Over the years, she'd stashed what she thought would be enough for an emergency like this, but she'd underestimated, and now she's running out of soy bits and soybeans. Luckily, everything in the garden is doing well. The chicken peas have begun to pod, the bananas are in flower, the polyberry bushes are covered with small brown nubbins of different shapes and sizes. She picks some spinach, flicks off the iridescent green beetles on it, steps on them. Then, feeling remorseful, she makes a thumbprint grave for them and says the words for the freeing of the soul and the asking of pardon. Even though no one's watching her, it's hard to break such ingrained habits. She relocates several slugs and snails and pulls out some weeds, leaving the purse lane. She can steam that later. On the delicate carrot fronds, she finds two bright blue kudzu moth caterpillars. Though developed as a biological control for invasive kudzu, they seem to prefer garden vegetables. In one of those jokey moves, so common in the first years of gene splicing, their designer gave them a baby face at the front end with big eyes and a happy smile, which makes them remarkably difficult to kill. She pulls them off the carrots, their mandibles chewing ravenously beneath their cutie pie masks, lifts the edge of the netting, and tosses them outside the fence. No doubt they'll be back. On the way back to the building, she finds the tail of a dog beside the path, an Irish setter it looks like, its long fur matted with burrs and twigs. A vulture's dropped it there, most likely. They're always dropping things. She tries not to think of the other things they dropped in the first weeks after the flood. Fingers were the worst. Her own hands are getting thicker, stiff and brown, like roots. She's been digging in the earth too much. Chapter 4. Toby, St. Bashir Alawasi Day. Year 25. She takes her baths in the early mornings before the sun's too hot. She keeps a number of pails and bowls up on the rooftop for collecting the afternoon storm rainwater. The spa has its own well, but the solar system's broken, so the pumps are useless. She does her laundry on the rooftop, too, spreading it out on the benches to dry. She uses the gray water to flush her toilet. She rubs herself with soap. There's still a lot of soap. All of it pink, and sponges off. My body is shrinking, she thinks. I'm puckering. I'm dwindling. Soon I'll be nothing but a hangnail. Though she's always been on the skinny side. Oh, Tabiatha, the ladies used to say. If only I had your figure. She dries herself off, slips on a pink smock. This one says, Melody. There's no need to label herself now that nobody's left to read the labels. So she's begun wearing the smocks of the others. Anita, Quintana, Ren, Carmel, Symphony. Those girls had been so cheerful, so hopeful. Not Ren, though. Ren had been sad. But Ren had left earlier. Then all of them had left, once the trouble hit. They'd gone home to be with their families, believing love could save them. You go ahead, I'll lock up, Toby had told them. And she had locked up, but with herself inside. She scrubs her long dark hair, twists it into a wet bun. She really must cut it, it's thick and too hot. Also, it smells of mutton. As she's drying her hair, she hears an odd sound. She goes cautiously to the rooftop railing. Three huge pigs are nosing around the swimming pool, two sows and a boar. The morning light shines on their plump, pinky-gray forms. They glisten like wrestlers. They seem too large and bulbous to be normal. She's spotted pigs like this before in the meadow, but they've never come this close. Escapees, they must be, from some experimental farm or other? They're grouped by the shallow end of the pool, gazing at it as if in thought, their snouts twitching. Maybe they're sniffing the dead raccunk floating on the surface of the scummy water. Will they try to retrieve it? They grunt softly to one another, then back away. The thing must be too putrid even for them. They pause for a final sniff, then trot around the corner of the building. Toby follows the railing, tracking them. They've found the garden fence. They're looking in. Then one of them begins to dig. They'll tunnel under. "Get away from there!" Toby shouts at them. They peer up at her, dismiss her. She scrambles down the stairs as fast as she can without slipping. Idiot! She should keep the rifle with her at all times. She grabs it from her bedside, hurries back up to the roof. She holds one of the pigs in the scope. The boar, an easy shot, he's sideways. But then she hesitates. "They're God's creatures. Never kill without just cause," said Adam One. "I'm warning you," she yells. Amazingly, they seem to understand her. They must have seen a weapon before, a spray gun, a stun gun. They squeal in alarm, then turn and run. They're a quarter of the way across the meadow when it occurs to her they'll be back. They'll dig under at night and root up her garden in no time flat, and that will be the end of her long-term food supply. She'll have to shoot them. It's self-defense. She squeezes off around, misses, tries again. The boar falls down. The two sows keep running. Only when they've reached the forest rim do they turn and look back. Then they meld with the foliage and are gone. Toby's hands are shaking. "You've snuffed a life," she tells herself. "You've acted rashly and from anger. You ought to feel guilty." Still, she thinks of going out with one of the kitchen knives and sawing off a ham. She'd taken the veggie vows when she joined the gardeners, but the prospect of a bacon sandwich is a great temptation right now. She resists it, however. Animal protein should be the last resort. She murmurs the standard gardener words of apology, though she doesn't feel apologetic, or not apologetic enough. She needs to do some target practice, shooting the boar, missing at first, letting the sows get away. That was clumsy. In recent weeks, she's grown lax about the rifle. Now she vows to cart it around with her wherever she goes, even up to the rooftop for a bath, even to the toilet, even to the garden, especially to the garden. Pigs are smart. They'll keep her in mind. They won't forgive her. Should she lock the door when she goes out? What if she has to run back into the spa building in a hurry? But if she leaves the door unlocked, someone or something could slip in when she's working in the garden and be waiting for her inside. She'll need to think of every angle. An Ararat without a wall isn't an Ararat at all, as the gardener children used to chant. A wall that cannot be defended is no sooner built than ended. The gardeners loved their instructive rhymes. Chapter 5. Toby went in search of the rifle a few days after the first outbreaks. It was the night after the girls had fled from a new you, leaving their pink smocks behind them. This was not an ordinary pandemic. It wouldn't be contained after a few hundred thousand deaths, then obliterated with biotools and bleach. This was the waterless flood the gardeners so often had warned about. It had all the signs. It traveled through the air as if on wings. It burned through cities like fire, spreading germ-ridden mobs, terror, and butchery. The lights were going out everywhere. The news was sporadic. Systems were failing as their keepers died. It looked like total breakdown, which was why she'd needed the rifle. Rifles were illegal, and getting caught with one would have been fatal a week earlier. But now, such laws were no longer a factor. The trip would be dangerous. She'd have to walk to her old plebe. No transport would be functioning. And locate the tacky little split level that had so briefly belonged to her parents. Then she'd have to dig the rifle up from where it had been buried. hoping no one would see her doing it. Walking that far would be no problem. She'd kept herself in shape. The hazard would be other people. The rioting was everywhere, according to what Fitful knew she could still pick up from her phone. She left the spa at dusk, locking the door behind her. She crossed the wide lawns and made her way to the northern entrance along the woodland walk, where the customers used to take their shady strolls. She'd be less visible there. There were still some glow lights marking the pathway. She met no one, though a green rabbit hopped into the bushes and a bob kitten crossed in front of her, turning to stare with its lambent eyes. The entrance gate was ajar. She slid through cautiously, half expecting a challenge. Then she set out across Heritage Park. People were hurrying past, singly and in groups, trying to get out of the city, hoping to make their way through the Plebeland sprawl and seek out refuge in the countryside. There was coughing, a child's wail. She almost stumbled over someone on the ground. By the time she reached the park's outer edge, it was pitch dark. She moved from tree to tree along the verge, hugging the shadows. The boulevard was jammed with cars, trucks, solar bikes, and buses, their drivers honking and shouting. Some of the vehicles had been overturned and were burning. In the shops, the looting was in full swing. There were no corpse-to-corpse men in sight. They must have been the first to desert, heading for their gated corporation strongholds to save their skins, and carrying, Toby certainly hoped, the lethal virus with them. From somewhere, there were gunshots. So backyards were already being dug up, thought Toby. Hers was not the only rifle. Up the street, there was a barricade, cars wedged together. It had its defenders, armed with what? As far as Toby could see, they were using metal pipes. The crowd was screaming at them in fury, throwing bricks and stones. They wanted past. They wanted to flee the city. What did the barricade holders want? Plunder, no doubt. Rape and money and other useless things. When the waterless waters rise, Adam One used to say, the people will try to save themselves from drowning. They will clutch at any straw. Be sure you are not that straw, my friends, for if you are clutched or even touched, you too will drown. Toby turned away from the barricade. She'd have to circle around it. She held herself back in the darkness, crouching along behind the foliage and skirting the park's rim. Now she'd reached the open space, where the gardeners used to hold their markets and the Cobb house where the kids once played. She hid behind it, waiting for a distraction. Soon enough, there was a crash and an explosion, and while all heads were turned, she ambled across. It's best not to run, Zeb had taught. Running away makes you a prey. The side streets were awash with people. She dodged to avoid them. She'd worn surgical gloves, a bulletproof vest made of silk from a spider goat splice lifted from the Anu Yu guardhouse a year ago, and a black nose cone air filter. From the garden shed, she'd brought a shovel and a crowbar, both of which could be lethal if used decisively. In her pocket was a bottle of Anu Yu Total Shine hairspray, an effective weapon if aimed at the eyes. She'd learned a lot of things from Zeb in his urban bloodshed limitation classes. In Zeb's view, the first bloodshed to be limited should be your own. She headed northeast, through upmarket Fernside, then through Big Box with its tracts of smallish, badly built houses, slipping along the narrowest streets, which were dimly lit and not crowded. Several people passed her, intent on their own stories. Two teenagers paused as if to try a mugging, but she began coughing and croaked out, "Help me!" And they scurried away. Around midnight, and after a few wrong turns, the streets in Big Box looked so much alike, she reached her parents' former house. No lights were on. The door to the garage was open, and the plate glass window at the front was smashed, so she didn't think anyone was in there. The current occupants were either dead or elsewhere. It was the same with the identical house next door, the one where the rifle was buried. She stood for a moment, calming herself down, listening to the blood in her head. Katush, katush, katush. Either the rifle was still there, or it was gone. If it was there, she'd have a rifle. If it was gone, she wouldn't have one. Nothing to panic about. She opened the neighbor's garden gate, stealthy as a thief. Darkness. No movement. The scent of night flowers. Lilies. Nicotiana. Mixed with that, a whiff of smoke from something burning blocks away, she could see the flare. A kudzu moth flickered against her face. She stuck the crowbar under a patio stone, lifted, grabbed the edge, heaved the stone over. Did it again and again. 3 patio stones. Then she dug with the shovel. A heartbeat. Then another. It was there. Don't cry, she told herself. Just cut open the plastic, grab the rifle and the ammunition, and get out of here. It took her 3 days to get back to a new U, skirting the worst rioting. There were muddy footprints on the outside steps, but no one had broken in. Chapter 6. The rifle is a primitive weapon, a Ruger 44-99 Deerfield. It had been her father's. He was the one who'd taught her to shoot when she was 12, back in those days that seem now like some mushroom-induced technicolor brain vacation. Aim for the center of the body, he'd said. Don't waste your time with heads. He said he just meant animals. They'd been living in the semi-country before the sprawl had rolled over that stretch of landscape. Their white frame house had 10 acres of trees around it, and there were squirrels and the first green rabbits. No raccoons, those hadn't been put together yet. There were a lot of deer, they'd get into her mother's vegetable garden. Toby had shot a couple, and helped to dress them. She can still remember the smell, and the slither of shining viscera. They'd eaten deer stew, and her mother had made soup with the bones. But mostly, Toby and her father shot tin cans, and rats at the dump. There'd still been a dump. She'd practiced a lot, which had pleased her dad. Great shot, pal, he'd say. Had he wanted a son? Perhaps. What he'd said was that everyone needed to know how to shoot. His generation believed that if there was trouble, all you'd have to do was shoot someone, and then it would be okay. Then the Corpse Corps had outlawed firearms in the interests of public security, reserving the newly invented spray guns for themselves. And suddenly, people were officially weaponless. Her father had buried his rifle and a supply of ammunition under a pile of discarded picket fencing and shown Toby where it was, in case she ever needed it. The Corpse Corps could have found it with their metal detectors. They were rumored to be doing sweeps. But they couldn't look everywhere, and her father was innocuous from their point of view. He sold air conditioning. He was a small potato. Then a developer wanted to buy his land. The offer was good, but Toby's father refused to sell. He liked it where he was, he said. So did Toby's mother, who ran the Healthwiser supplements franchise in the nearest shopping area. They turned down another offer, then a third. We'll build around you, said the developer. Toby's father said that was okay with him. By this time, it had become a matter of principle. He thought the world was still the way it had been 50 years before, thinks Toby. He shouldn't have been so stubborn. Already back then, the Corpse Corps were consolidating their power. They'd started as a private security firm for the corporations, but then they'd taken over when the local police forces collapsed for lack of funding, and people liked that at first because the corporations paid. But now, Corpse Corps were sending their tentacles everywhere. He should have caved. First, he lost his job with the air conditioning corp. He got another one selling thermal windows, but it paid less. Then Toby's mother came down with a strange illness. She couldn't understand it because she'd always been so careful about her health. She worked out. She ate a lot of vegetables. She took a dose of Healthwiser high-potency VitalVite supplements daily. Franchise operators like her got a deal on the supplements, their own customized package, just like the ones for the higher-ups at Healthwiser. She took more supplements, but despite that, she became weak and confused and lost weight rapidly. It was as if her body had turned against itself. No doctor could give her a diagnosis, though many tests were done by the HealthWiser Core clinics. They took an interest because she'd been such a faithful user of their products. They arranged for special care with their own doctors. They charged for it, though, and even with the discount for members of the HealthWiser franchise family, it was a lot of money. And because the condition had no name, her parents' modest health insurance plan refused to cover the costs. Nobody could get public wellness coverage unless they had no money of their own whatsoever. Not that you'd want to go to one of those public dump bins anyway, thought Toby. All they did was poke at your tongue and give you a few germs and viruses you didn't already have and send you home. Toby's father took out a second mortgage and poured the money into the doctors and the drugs and the hired nurses in the hospitals, but Toby's mother continued to wither away. Her father had to sell their white frame house then, for a much lower price than the one he'd first been offered. The day after the sale closed, the bulldozers flattened the place. Her father bought another house, a tiny split level in a new subdivision, the one nicknamed Big Box, because it was flanked by a whole flotilla of megastores. He dug up his rifle from under the picket fencing, smuggled it to the new house, and buried it again, this time under the patio stones in the barren little backyard. Then he'd lost his thermal window job because he'd taken too much time off due to his wife's illness. His solar car had to be sold. Then the furniture disappeared, piece by piece. Not that Toby's father could get much for it. People can smell desperation on you, he said to Toby. They take advantage. This conversation took place over the phone because Toby had made it to college despite the lack of family cash. She'd got a meager scholarship from the Martha Graham Academy, which she was fleshing out by waiting tables in the student cafeteria. She wanted to come home and help out with her mother, who'd been shipped back from the hospital and was sleeping on the main floor sofa because she couldn't climb stairs. But her father said no. Toby should stay at college because there was nothing she could do. Finally, even the tacky Big Box house had to be put up for sale. The sign was on the lawn when Toby came home for her mother's funeral. Her father by that time was a wreck. Humiliation, pain, and failure had eaten away at him until there was almost nothing left. Her mother's funeral was short and dreary. After it, Toby sat with her father in the stripped-down kitchen. They drank a six-pack between them, Toby two, her father four. Then after Toby had gone to bed, her father went into the empty garage and stuck the Ruger into his mouth and pulled the trigger. Toby heard the shot. She knew at once what it was. She'd seen the rifle standing behind the door in the kitchen. He must have dug it up for a reason, but she hadn't allowed herself to imagine what that reason might be. She couldn't face what was in the garage. She lay in bed, skipping ahead in time. What to do? If she called the authorities, even a doctor or an ambulance, they'd find the bullet wound and then they'd demand the rifle. And Toby would be in trouble as the daughter of an admitted lawbreaker, one who'd owned a forbidden weapon. That would be the least of it. They might accuse her of murder. After what seemed hours, she forced herself to move. In the garage, she tried not to look too closely. She wrapped what was left of her father in a blanket, then in plastic heavy-duty garbage bags, sealed him with duct tape, and buried him under the patio stones. She felt terrible about it, but it was a thing he'd have understood. He'd been a practical man, but sentimental under that. Power tools in the shed, roses on birthdays. If he'd been nothing but practical, he'd have marched into the hospital with the divorce papers the way a lot of men did when something too debilitating and expensive struck their wives. Left her mother to be tossed out onto the street. Stayed solvent. Instead, he'd spent all their money. Toby wasn't much for standard religion. None of her family had been. They'd gone to the local church because the neighbors did and it would have been bad for business not to. But she'd heard her father say, privately, and after a couple of drinks, that there were too many crooks in the pulpit and too many dupes in the pews. Nevertheless, Toby had whispered a short prayer over the patio stones, earth to earth. Then she'd brushed sand into the cracks. She'd wrapped up the rifle in its plastic again and buried it under the patio stones of the house next door, which seemed to be empty, windows dark, no car in evidence. Maybe they'd been foreclosed. She'd taken that chance, trespassing on the neighbors, because if her father's body settled and they dug up the yard, and she'd buried the rifle beside him, it would be found too, and she wanted it to stay where it was.
"You never know," her father used to say, "when you might need it."
And that was right. You never did know. It's possible a neighbor or two saw her digging around in the dark, but she didn't think they'd tell. They wouldn't want to draw the lightning down anywhere near their own possibly weapon-filled backyards. She hosed the blood off the garage floor, then took a shower. Then she went to bed. She lay in the darkness, wanting to cry, but all she felt was cold, though it wasn't cold at all. She couldn't sell the house without revealing that she was the owner now because her father was dead, thus unleashing a whole dumpster load of garbage onto her own head. Where, for instance, was the corpse, and how had it become one? So in the morning, after a sparse breakfast, she put the dishes in the sink and walked out of the house. She didn't even take a suitcase. What was there to pack? Most likely, the Corpse Corpse wouldn't bother tracing her. There was nothing in it for them. One of the corporation banks would get the house anyway. If her disappearance was of interest to anyone, such as maybe her college, where was she? Was she ill? Had she been in an accident? The Corpse Corpse would spread it about that she'd been last seen with a cruising pimp on the lookout for fresh recruits, which is what you'd expect in the case of a young woman like her. A young woman in desperate financial straits with no visible relations and no nest egg or trust fund or fallback. People would shake their heads. A shame, but what could you do? And at least she had something of marketable value, namely her young ass, and therefore she wouldn't starve to death and nobody had to feel guilty. The Corpse Corpse always substituted rumor for action if action would cost them anything. They believed in the bottom line. As for her father, everyone would assume he'd changed his name and vanished into one of these seedier plebes to avoid paying for her mother's funeral with money he didn't have. That sort of thing was happening all the time. Chapter 7. The period that followed was a bad time for Toby. Though she'd hidden the evidence and managed to disappear, there was still a chance the Corpse Corpse might come after her for her father's debts. She didn't have any money they could seize, but there were stories about female debtors being farmed out for sex. If she had to make her living on her back, she at least wanted to keep the proceeds. She'd burned her identity and didn't have the cash to buy a new one, not even a cheap one, without the DNA infusion or the skin color change, so she couldn't get a legitimate job. Those were mostly controlled by the corporations. But if you sank deep down, down where names disappeared and no histories were true, the Corpse Corpse wouldn't bother with you. She rented a tiny room. She had enough money left from her cafeteria savings for that. A room of her own, which might save her few possessions from theft by some dubious roommate. It was on the top floor of a fire trap commercial building in one of the worst plebes. Willow Acres was its name, though the locals called it the sewage lagoon because a lot of shit ended up in it. She shared the bathroom with 6 illegal Thai immigrants who kept very quiet. It was said that the Corpse Corpse had decided that expelling illegals was too expensive, so they'd resorted to the method used by farmers who found a diseased cow in the herd. Shoot, shovel, and shut up. On the floor below her, there was an endangered species luxury couture operation called Slink. They sold Halloween costumes over the counter to fool the animal rider extremists and cured the skins in the back rooms. The fumes came up through the ventilation system. Though Toby tried stuffing pillows into the vent, her cubicle stank of chemicals and rancid fat. Sometimes there was roaring and bleeding as well. They killed the animals on the premises because the customers didn't want goat dressed up as oryx or dyed wolf instead of wolverine. They wanted their bragging rights to be genuine. The skinned carcasses were sold onto a chain of gourmet restaurants called Rarity. The public dining room served steak and lamb and venison and buffalo. certified disease-free so it could be cooked rare. That was what rarity pretended to mean. But in the private banquet rooms, key club entry, bouncer enforced, you could eat endangered species. The profits were immense. One bottle of tiger bone wine alone was worth a neckful of diamonds. Technically, the endangered trade was illegal. There were high fines for it. But it was very lucrative. People in the neighborhood knew about it, but they had their own worries. And who could you tell without risk? There were pockets within pockets, with a Corpsichorp's hand in each one of them. Toby got a job as a furzooter, cheap day labor, no identity required. The furzooters put on fake fur animal suits with cartoon heads and hung advertising signs around their necks and worked the higher-end malls and the boutique retail streets. But it was hot and humid inside the furzoots, and the range of vision was limited. In the first week, she suffered 3 attacks by fetishists who knocked her over, twisted the big head around so she was blinded, and rubbed their pelvises against her fur, making strange noises, of which the meows were the most recognizable. It wasn't rape. No part of her actual body was touched. But it was creepy. Also, it was distasteful, dressing up as bears and tigers and lions and the other endangered species she could hear being slaughtered on the floor below her. So she stopped doing that. Then she made a lump of quick cash by selling her hair. The hair market hadn't yet been decimated by the mohair sheep breeders. That happened a few years later. So there were still scalpers who'd buy from anyone, no questions asked. She'd had long hair then, and although it was medium brown, not the best color, they preferred blonde, it had fetched a decent sum. After the money from the hair was used up, she'd sold her eggs on the black market. Young women could get top dollar for donating their eggs to couples who hadn't been able to pay the required bribe, or else were so truly unsuitable that no official would sell them a parenthood license anyway. But she could only pull the egg stunt twice, because the second time the extraction needle had been infected. At that time, the egg traders were still paying for treatment if anything went wrong. Still, it took her a month to recover. When she tried a third time, they told her there were complications. So she could never donate any more eggs or, incidentally, have any children herself. Toby hadn't known, until then, that she'd wanted any children. She'd had a boyfriend back at Martha Graham who used to talk about marriage and a family. Stan was his name. But Toby had said they were far too young and poor to consider it. She was studying holistic healing, lotions and potions, the students called it, and Stan was in problematics and quadruple-entry creative asset planning, at which he was doing well. His family wasn't rich, or he wouldn't have been at a third-rate institution like Martha Graham, but he was ambitious and fully intended to prosper. On their more tranquil evenings, Toby would rub her flower preparations and herbal extract projects on him, and after that there would be a round of crisp, botanical remedy-flavored sex, followed by a shower off and some popcorn, without salt or fat. But once her family hit the downdraft, Toby knew she couldn't afford Stan. She also knew her days at college were numbered, so she'd cut off contact. She didn't even answer his reproachful text messages, because there was no future in it. He wanted a 2-professionals marriage, and she was no longer in the running. Better to do the weeping sooner rather than later, she told herself. But it seems she'd wanted children after all, because when she was told she'd been accidentally sterilized, she could feel all the light leaking out of her. After getting that news, she'd blown her hoarded egg donation money on a drug-fueled holiday from reality. But waking up with various men she'd never seen before had lost its thrill very quickly, especially when she'd found they had a habit of pocketing her spare change. After the 4th or 5th time, she knew she had to make a decision. Did she want to live, or did she want to die? If die, there were quicker ways. If live, she had to live differently. Through one of her single-nighters, a man with the sewage lagoon equivalent of a kind soul, she found a job at a plebe mob business. Plebe mob businesses didn't ask for identity and didn't need references. If you dipped into the till, they'd simply cut your fingers off. Toby's new job was with a chain called Secret Burgers. The secret of Secret Burgers was that no one knew what sort of animal protein was actually in them. The counter girls wore t-shirts and baseball caps with the slogan, Secret Burgers, because everyone loves a secret. The job paid rock-bottom wages, but you got 2 free Secret Burgers a day. Once she was with the gardeners and had taken the veggie vows, Toby suppressed the memory of eating these burgers. But, as Adam Wan used to say, hunger is a powerful reorganizer of the conscience. The meat grinders weren't 100% efficient. You might find a swatch of cat fur in your burger, or a fragment of mouse tail. Was there a human fingernail once? It was possible. The local plebe mobs paid the Corpsicorps men to turn a blind eye. In return, the Corpsicorps let the plebe mobs run the low-level kidnappings and assassinations, the skunkweed grow-ops, the crack labs and street drug retailing, and the plank shops that were their stock in trade. They also ran corpse disposals, harvesting organs for transplant, then running the gutted carcasses through the Secret Burgers grinders. So went the worst rumors. During the glory days of Secret Burgers, there were very few bodies found in vacant lots. If there was a so-called reality TV expose, the Corpsicorps would make a pretense at investigation. Then they'd list the case as unsolved and discard it. They had an image to uphold among those citizens who still paid lip service to the old ideals. Defenders of the peace, enforcers of public security, keeping the streets safe. It was a joke even then, but most people felt the Corpsicorps were better than total anarchy. Even Toby felt that. The year before, Secret Burgers had gone too far. The Corpsicorps had closed them down after one of their high-placed officials went slumming in the sewage lagoon, and his shoes were discovered on the feet of a Secret Burgers meat grinder operator. So for a while, stray cats breathed easier at night. But a few months later, the familiar grilling booths were sizzling again, because who could say no to a business with so few supply-side costs? Chapter 8. Toby was pleased to learn she'd got the Secret Burgers job. She could pay the rent. She wouldn't starve. But then she discovered the catch. The catch was the manager. His name was Blanco, though behind his back, the Secret Burgers girls called him the Bloat. Rebecca Eckler, who worked Toby's shift, told her about him right away. "Stay off his radar," she said. "Maybe you'll be okay. He's doing that girl Dora, and he mostly does just the one at a time, and you're kind of scrawny, and he likes the curvy butts. But if he tells you to come to the office, look out. He's real jealous. He'll take a girl apart."
"Has he asked you," said Toby, "to the office?"
"Praise the Lord and spit," said Rebecca. "I'm too black and ugly for him. Plus, he just likes the kittens, not the old cats. Maybe you should wrinkle yourself up, sweetheart, knock out a few of your teeth."
"You're not ugly," said Toby. Rebecca was, in fact, beautiful in a substantial way, with her brown skin and her red hair and her Egyptian nose.
"I don't mean ugly like that," said Rebecca. "Ugly to deal with. Us Jellacks, we're 2 kinds of folks you don't want to mess with. He knows I'd get the black and red fish onto him, and they're one mean gang, plus maybe the wolf Isaiahists, way too much grief."
Toby had no such backups. She kept her head down when Blanco was around. She'd heard his story. According to Rebecca, he'd been a bouncer at Scales, the classiest club in the lagoon. Bouncers had status. They strolled around in black suits and dark glasses, looking suave but tough, and they had women swarming all over them.
"But Blanco had blown it big time," said Rebecca. "He'd ripped up a Scales girl, not a smuggled illegal alien temporary. They got ripped up all the time. But one of the top talent, a star pole dancer. You couldn't have a guy like that around, someone who'd mess up the works because he couldn't keep his cool, so they'd fired him. Lucky for him, he had friends in the Corpsicorps, or he'd have ended up minus some body parts in a carbon garboil dumpster. As it was, they'd stuck him in to run the Sewage Lagoon Secret Burgers outlet. It was a big come down, and he was bitter about it. Why should he suffer because of some slut? So he hated the job.
but he figured the girls were his perks. He had two pals, ex-bouncers like himself, who acted as his bodyguards, and they got the leavings, supposing there was anything left. Blanco was still bouncer-shaped, oblong and hefty, though running to fat. Too much beer, said Rebecca. He'd kept the signature bouncer ponytail at the back of his balding head, and he sported a full set of arm tattoos, snakes twining his arms, bracelets of skulls around his wrists, veins and arteries on the backs of his hands so they looked flayed. Around his neck was a tattooed chain, with a lock on it, shaped like a red heart, nestled into the chest hair he displayed in the V of his open shirt. According to rumor, that chain went right down his back, twined around an upside-down naked woman whose head was stuck in his ass. Toby kept her eye on Dora, who'd arrive at the grilling booth to take over when Toby's shift was done. She'd begun as a plump optimist, but over the weeks, she'd been shrinking and sagging. On the white skin of her arms, the bruises bloomed and faded. She wants to run away, Rebecca whispered, but she's scared. Maybe you should get out of here yourself. He's been looking at you. I'll be okay, said Toby. She didn't feel okay. She felt scared. But where else could she go? She lived from pay to pay. She had no money. The next morning, Rebecca signaled Toby over. Dora's dead, she said. Tried to run. I just heard it. Found her in a vacant lot. Neck broke. Cut to bits. Saying it was some crazy. But it was him, said Toby. Course it was him, Rebecca sniffed. He's bragging. At noon that same day, Blanco ordered Toby to his office. He sent his two pals with the message. They walked on either side of her just in case she might get flighty ideas. As they went along the street, the heads turned. Toby felt she was on the way to her own execution. Why hadn't she quit when she had the chance? The office was through a grimy door tucked behind a carbon garboil dumpster. It was a small room with a desk, filing cabinet, and battered leather couch. Blanco heaved himself out of his swivel chair, grinning.
Skinny bitch, I'm promoting you, he said. Say thank you.
Toby could only whisper. She felt strangled.
See this heart, said Blanco. He pointed to his tattoo. It means I love you. And now you love me too, right?
Toby managed to nod.
Smart girl, said Blanco. Come here, take off my shirt.
The tattoo on his back was just as Rebecca had described it, a naked woman, wound in chains, her head invisible, her long hair waving up like flames. Blanco put his flayed hands around her neck.
Cross me up, I'll snap you like a twig, he said.
Chapter 9. Ever since her family had died in such sad ways, ever since she herself had disappeared from official view, Toby had tried not to think about her earlier life. She'd covered it in ice. She'd frozen it. Now she longed, desperately, to be back there in the past, even the bad parts, even the grief, because her present life was torture. She tried to picture her two faraway, long-ago parents watching over her like guardian spirits, but she saw only mist. She'd been Blanco's one and only for less than 2 weeks, but it felt like years. His view was that a woman with an ass as skinny as Toby's should consider herself in luck if any man wanted to stick his whole hammer into her. She'd be even luckier if he didn't sell her to Scales as a temporary, which meant temporarily alive. She should thank her lucky stars. Better, she should thank him. He demanded a thank you after every degrading act. He didn't want her to feel pleasure, though, only submission. Nor did he give her any time off from her secret burger's duties. He demanded her services during her lunch break, the whole half hour, which meant she got no lunch. Day by day, she was hungrier and more exhausted. She had her own bruises now, like poor Dora's. Despair was taking her over. She could see where this was going, and it looked like a dark tunnel. She'd be used up soon. Worse, Rebecca had gone away. No one knew exactly where, off with some religious group, said the street rumor. Blanco didn't care, because Rebecca hadn't been part of his harem. He filled her secret burger's place quickly enough. Toby was working the morning shift when a strange procession approached along the street. From the signs they were carrying and the singing they were doing, she guessed it was a religious thing, though it wasn't a sect she'd ever seen before. A lot of fringe cults worked the sewage lagoon, trolling for souls in torment. The known fruits and the Petro-Baptists and the other rich people religions kept away, but a few wattled old Salvation Army bands shuffled through, wheezing under the weight of their drums and French horns. Groups of turbaned, pure-heart brethren Sufis might twirl past, or black-clad ancients of days, or clumps of saffron-robed Hare Krishnas, tinkling and chanting, attracting jeers and rotting vegetation from the bystanders. The lion Isaiahists and the wolf Isaiahists both preached on street corners, battling when they met. They were at odds over whether it was the lion or the wolf that would lie down with the lamb once the peaceable kingdom had arrived. When there were scuffles, the plebrat gangs, the brown Tex-Mexes, the pallid lint heads, the yellow Asian fusions, the black and red fish, would swarm the fallen, rooting through their draperies for anything valuable or even just portable. As the procession drew nearer, Toby had a better view. The leader had a beard and was wearing a caftan that looked as if it had been sewn by elves on hash. Behind him came an assortment of children, various heights, all colors, but all in dark clothing, holding their slates with slogans printed on them. God's gardeners for God's garden. Don't eat death. Animals are us. They looked like raggedy angels, or else like midget bag people. They'd been the ones doing the singing. No meat, no meat, no meat, they were chanting now. She'd heard of this cult. It was said to have a garden somewhere on a rooftop. A wadge of drying mud, a few draggled marigolds, a mangy row of pathetic beans, broiling in the unforgiving sun. The procession drew up in front of the Secret Burger's booth. A crowd was gathering, readying itself to jeer. My friends, said the leader to the crowd at large. His preaching wouldn't go on for long, thought Toby, because the sewage lagooners wouldn't tolerate it. My dear friends, my name is Adam One. I, too, was once a materialistic, atheistic meat eater. Like you, I thought man was the measure of all things.
Shut the fuck up, Echo Freak, someone yelled.
Adam One ignored this.
In fact, dear friends, I thought measurement was the measure of all things. Yes, I was a scientist. I studied epidemics. I counted diseased and dying animals, and people, too, as if there were so many pebbles. I thought that only numbers could give a true description of reality. But then...
Piss off, dickhead!
But then one day, when I was standing right where you are standing, devouring, yes, devouring a secret burger and reveling in the fat thereof, I saw a great light. I heard a great voice. And that voice said,
it said, get stuffed!
It said, spare your fellow creatures. Do not eat anything with a face. Do not kill your own soul. And then, Toby felt the crowd, the way they were poised to surge. They'd stomp this poor fool into the ground, and the little gardener children with him. Go away, she said as loudly as she could.
Adam One gave her a courtly little bow, a kindly smile.
My child, he said. Do you have any idea what you're selling? Surely you wouldn't eat your own relatives.
I would, Toby said, if I was hungry enough. Please go.
I see you've had a difficult time, my child, said Adam One. You have grown a callous and hard shell. But that hard shell is not your true self. Inside that shell, you have a warm and tender heart and a kind soul.
It was true about the shell. She knew she'd hardened. But her shell was her armor. Without it, she'd be mush.
"This asshole bothering you?" said Blanco.
He'd loomed up behind her, as he was in the habit of doing. He put his hand on her waist, and she could see it even without looking at it. The veins, the arteries, raw flesh.
"It's okay," said Toby. "He's harmless."
Adam One showed no sign of dislodging himself. He carried on as if no one else had spoken.
"You long to do good in this world, my child."
"I'm not your child," said Toby.
She was more than aware that she wasn't anyone's child, not anymore.
"We are all one another's children," said Adam One with a sad look.
"Scram," said Blanco, "before I knot you."
"Please leave or you'll get injured," said Toby as urgently as she could.
This man had no fear. She lowered her voice, hissed at him.
"Piss off now."
"It is you who will be injured," said Adam One. "Every day you stand here selling the mutilated flesh of God's beloved creatures, it's injuring you more.
Join us, my dear. We are your friends. We have a place for you."
"Get your fucking paws off my worker, you fucking pervert," Blanco shouted.
"Am I bothering you, my child?" said Adam One, ignoring him.
"I certainly haven't touched."
Blanco came out from behind the booth and lunged, but Adam One seemed used to being attacked.
He stepped to the side and Blanco rocketed forward into the group of singing children, knocking some of them down and falling down himself. A teenage linthead promptly hit him over the head with an empty bottle. Blanco wasn't a neighborhood favorite, and he sank down, bleeding from a gash on his head.
Toby ran around to the front of the grilling booth. Her first impulse was to help him up because she'd be in big trouble later if she didn't. A pack of redfish pleabrats was mauling him, and some Asian fusions were working on his shoes. The crowd moved in around him, but now he was struggling to right himself. Where were his two bodyguards? Nowhere to be seen.
Toby felt curiously exhilarated. Then she kicked Blanco's head. She did it without even thinking. She felt herself grinning like a dog. She felt her foot connect with his skull. It was like a towel-covered stone. As soon as she'd done it, she realized her mistake. How could she have been so dumb?
"Come away, my dear," said Adam One, taking her by the elbow. "It would be best. You've lost your job in any case."